Everyone, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Susan. Glad to be here tonight with my people. And so I didn't prepare anything. I'm not that kind of speaker. I just suit up and show up and pray and, you know, ask God to talk through me if he would. And here I am. So my sobriety date is April 19th of 1997. My home group is Bon Air Big Book Study in Bon Air, which is in Richmond, Virginia. And I have a sponsor, and I am a sponsor. So those are the particulars. Especially grateful to be out here tonight because I just celebrated my anniversary. So I thought it was a great time to be asked to speak, to do a little bit of service to help me stay sober and hopefully, you know, you guys. So that's the only thing that I ask, you know, that God, you know, put me to whatever maximum service that I can be to him and his fellows. And hopefully, you know, if there's something that I share that's helpful, I know it'll help me because I need to remember where I came from. And I love those two paragraphs in the big book that talk about how we found God, really, how I found God and how I came to that spiritual awakening. And it certainly didn't happen overnight. And like a good garden variety drunk, I had to bash my head in for, you know, many days. I had to become really desperate in order to become surrendered and willing to do anything different than my own ideas. You know, I tried for a long time to enjoy and control my drinking on my own ideas and how I was going to manage to do that. And my ideas never worked. So I was born in Charlottesville, but I was really raised in Richmond and have spent most of my life there with the exception of a few years here and there. I love the drive coming out here. And it was just a great way to start the evening and start a meeting. So I started drinking young. I believe my dad probably had a problem with alcohol. You know, that's just my opinion. But there was a lot of alcohol in our homes. When we were growing up, and my parents would have parties and have people over, and that's how I started drinking. I'd be a little hostess at a very young age, you know, clearing off the tables after the parties. And I don't know what gave me the idea that, you know, I should try what was left over in any of the glasses. I didn't know any better. You know, I don't know. But I think the phenomenon of craving set off inside of my body at a very young age. And by the time that I was 15, I was getting arrested for drunk in public and whatnot. And by the time I was 17, I was facing criminal charges for drug trafficking and conspiracy. I mean, y'all know, you know, the stuff that we get into. And turned 18 and went before a grand jury trial. And that kind of cured me of my powder alcohol addiction. But some of my others. But I can tell you, it did not cure me of my alcoholism. And what I would come to find out that there was no sufficient reason that I was presented with that would solve my alcohol problem. And I have known people, and my dad was one of them. My dad found God in church and quit drinking, and that was that. you know, and I've known people who have had, you know, trouble with their drinking, and with sufficient reason, they have stopped. And I can tell you, I had plenty of sufficient reasons. I was an abnormal drinker from the get-go, and I certainly didn't want to be. You know, I wanted to be the person that was like everyone else that's, you know, I was around. I mean, even the people that were partying that I hung out with seemed to be able to not have the consequences and have their life consumed with alcohol like mine did, because I planned everything around alcohol. If, you know, I had to go somewhere, I had to plan. Was I going to be able to drink before I got there? Was I going to be able to drink while I was there? Was I going to be able to drink when I left? You know, and this was not how I intended to live my life. You know, I had all intentions of being the good little citizen that showed up for life, that had a job, got married, had two kids. You know, 2.5 cars in the driveway and the white picket fence, you know, and I was going to go to college and I was going to do all of these things. I didn't have big dreams, but I had, you know, those ideas of what life should look like. And that's, you know, all I wanted. And I mean, I tried everything I could to make that happen. And it just, I could never get it right. I could never seem to, my life just kept falling apart. Every time I try to manage it and get it all back together and manage myself, you know, I would just bring it all back down and, you know, just burn my life down. And I did it over and over again. I did get married and I did have kids and I did get divorced several times. And I lost my children. I lost custody of my children. You know, and what that looked like was me wanting desperately to be a mother, because that is one of the things that I held really close to my heart, was I wanted to be a mom and to be a good mom to my children. And I believe that was one of the consequences that I thought, for sure now I'm going to not drink. For sure now, you know, I'm going to be able to not drink. I'm going to do what they asking me to do, you know. And if the Child Protective Services get involved, there is a whole long laundry list of what they ask you to do, in addition to, you know, the long list that the judge wants you to do for the other criminal charges I had against me. So, I mean, there were a lot of reasons, but being able to see my children after having lost them, lost custody of them, was the top of the priority list. And I think it finally occurred to me how powerless that I was over alcohol, when I couldn't muster up not being able to drink in order to be able to even have supervised visitation with my kids. Because it got to the point for me that when I drank, I was crazy, you know, and you know, by looking at me, nobody would have ever known that's the way that was going to turn out, you know. But every time, you know, I'm like the and more about alcoholism, where it talks about the different types of drinkers. I mean, it was a Jekyll and Hyde situation for a while, but, you know, that whole split personality thing, it soon ended for me, because I couldn't pull off not having a day without drinking. So I lost a lot of jobs. And the profession that I had gotten into when I was, uh, I back in high school, I'd gone into like the office technology program because I could leave school early to go to work. And, you know, they'd let me leave at 11:30 so I could go on off to work, but I didn't have to be to work till 10 minutes to two. So that left me a nice chunk of time, you know, to be able to do some partying before I went. But I worked at a bank as a teller. So, you know, I had to supplement the alcohol with the dry goods, you know, before work at that point. But I stayed in that profession. And by the time I was 18, I had started working in the real estate department of that same bank. I was recommended for this position as the real estate officer's assistant. And so that began my career in the mortgage business. And when you're in a professional setting like that, they don't really take kindly to you coming to work drunk. That's, you know, and those people like to have fun. They like to have their, you know, drinking times and whatnot, but they prefer it to be after hours. I mean, even having a liquid lunch was frowned upon at that time. So I just kept getting in trouble. And you know what I would do is every time I was going to be on the brink of getting fired, I'd quit and get me another job somewhere else, you know, before my reputation got so tarnished that I wasn't going to be able to be employed. But, you know, after doing that time and time again, word kind of gets around. But the last real job that I held during the time that during my drinking days, I worked for this mortgage company that's not around anymore. And they were so good to me. And they really tried to help me. You know, it was like they had some kind of inside knowledge. They'd done their homework, you know, on how to handle people who might have some type of emotional, mental or addiction, you know, some type of behavioral problems. So they had sent me off to treatment, and they had my boss. She told me, she said, you know, Susan, you're the best employee I've got, but you come to work drunk, you call out drunk, and I can't keep you. And of course I'm like, send me to treatment, you know, sign me up. We can get the heat off, you know. And I went off to treatment and I came back on fire. You know, it was just one more attempt and one more failure. There were a lot of those. Because I would be separated from alcohol for a time. Usually not my own idea, even though that time, you know, it was kind of my idea, but it was just to save my job. But when I got separated from alcohol, you know, my mind would clear up and I really wanted to be sober during that time. I'd come back and I was like, oh, this is great. I'm going to be sober, blah, blah. And I just turn up drunk. And, you know, it's like that, that part in the big book where it talks about how, you know, the time's going to come that if there's nothing standing between me and the next drink, if I don't have that power greater than myself to stand between me and the next one, I'm going to get drunk, you know. And I didn't know that then, you know. I know that now, but I had no idea about that then. And they weren't teaching that in treatment. They weren't teaching that in the programs that I was being sent to by the judge or by the CPS people. You know, if they were, I wasn't hearing it. So, I mean, maybe they were. And, you know, my alcoholic brain was not able to hear that message at the time. So I, you know, I came back on fire and, you know, I'm going to be great and I'm going to be sober. And I ended up drunk again. Well, when I ended up drunk that time, it was on a weekend and I was trying to play catch up because I'd been out of work And I had a whole bunch of loans in my trunk of my car that I was going to do some work on so that we could sell them off on the secondary market. And well, I ended up in jail and they impounded my car. And I think I might have used to know how long I was in jail that time, but I don't really remember anymore. You know, I could tell you a certain period of time, you know, 30 days or whatever, but I'd just be making it up because I really just don't remember. You know, that's part of my alcoholism is that, you know, I have a lot of blank spots, and a lot of lack of memory. So they ended up losing quite a lot of money because they didn't know where I was. They didn't know where their loan notes were, and those notes were to be sold so they could make their money and their MIA. Yeah, so I got in a lot of trouble, and I didn't get that job back after that. That was and that was the last real job that I held, and that was shortly after my second child was born, my son. He was born in 95, and that was probably about 6 months after he was born, and I lost that job. So after that, any job that I held was very short-lived. You know, I didn't know how to do anything else, for one thing, and I couldn't stop drinking. You know, I'd come to in the morning, and I'd have to drink. And I'd drink until I passed out, you know, and then I'd come to, and then I'd have to figure out how I'm going to get the next, you know, bottle. And I was still married to his father, and his father was an alcoholic as well. He was a, just a chronic alcoholic, just as much as I was. I used to think he was the sick one, you know, that was my excuse for quite a while too. Well, if you had him for a husband, you'd drink too, you know, because that's the only way I can deal with him. And, you know, he's violent and destructive and this and that and the other. And, you know, but that wasn't, you know, none of that was true. Well, all of that was true about him, but it wasn't true that he was the reason that I drank, for sure. I drank alcoholically long before that man ever came into the picture. But what he did do for me, which turned out to be something that was very meaningful, that probably led me to my bottom faster than I would have otherwise, is he taught me about the morning drink. And you know, the first time that he and I were together, and I, you know, was so sick and just shaking and, you know, just really, really ill from not drinking. He said, you just need to have a couple shots. You'll be fine. I'm like, what? Like, how did I not know this, you know? And why did this sound like a good idea? So, you know, and that's when the morning drinking started. And when that started, you know, that's when the downward spiral really was moving fast once that happened, because it got to that, you know, drinking to blackout, pass out, come to and start it all over again, and the search for how am I going to get the next one. And he's right there with me, you know, and trying to make money best we can, beg, borrow, steal, you know, from family members and whatnot. So he and I drank a little bit differently because he was able to binge and then stop drinking for several months at a time. I couldn't pull that off. I didn't want to pull that off, for one thing. But even if I would have really wanted to, I think I could have pulled that off. So it did get to that point where I did want to stop drinking. You know, when you've lost your job and your children have been removed from your custody, and your family is like, we would rather you stay in jail because at least we know you're alive in there. At least we know you're safe. And that's the way they felt about me going to jail. They would not bail me out. They bailed me out one time when I was, I don't know how old I was. I was in my early 20s. And that was the only time they bailed me out of jail. And all the other times they're like, nope, we're glad you're there. You know, glad to hear that you are safe and alive in jail. So please stay there. You know, that's that to me, that was part of the wreckage of my past that I still owe living amends for. You know, that I still, with my family, make sure that they know where I am, what I'm doing. My life is an open book with them. You know, there's no lies, no secrets. And that was my whole life before, was secrets and lies and manipulation. And, you know, so that has been, you know, a big part of my amends process with them. As a mother of adult children, and my son is almost 28, and he's an alcoholic. He's sober now for like 9 weeks.
Wow.
As his mother, I have gotten a taste in the last 5 years of what my parents went through with me. And so it's kind of come back on me, you know, even more so, just having that experience on the other side. And I know a lot of us in these rooms end up having that experience. So I know I'm not alone, you know, and I have people in this program that I'm able to talk to. And I also go to Families Anonymous, which has been great for me. But the loss of that relationship with people that were most important to me, between my family and my children, was huge. And I but it didn't matter, you know, what I did. I couldn't not drink. I lost any ability to control my drinking years ago. And even when I was faced with having time away from the drink, whether it was jail or, you know, some type of program or another, I mean, that phenomenon of craving, I was no match. You know, alcohol was my master, whether I was physically drinking it or not. I had an obsession of the mind. You know, that was going to condemn me to a life of alcoholism. And I got to a place where I knew I was licked, and I saw I had no hope. I lost any bit of hope that I'd ever had. And I really was drinking to die. You know, I couldn't see how I was ever going to be able to see my children and be a mom to my children again, how I was ever going to be able to repair the relationships that I damaged with my family. I didn't think it was ever going to be possible to have the life that I thought that I would have, you know, with the house and the children and being a mom and having a job and all of those normal things. All of that seemed like a fairy tale at this point in my drinking. You know, I'd make it up to the convenience store by before six, but you know, I'd have to wait till six till they'd sell me something. And You know, I see people going off to their jobs, you know, coming in and going off to work, you know, and I got to the place where my alcohol reality was the only reality for me anymore. I became so delusional that even seeing other people living a normal life, I couldn't fathom what they were doing. I'm like, what are they doing? Like, what is happening? What is going on? Because I felt like I was in this isolated little bubble, and that no one understood what was happening. And so, you know, I'd get my alcohol that way, and I just was at that place where was everything I could do just to be able to drink enough. And I was drinking. I feel like I was drinking to die. And I had several incidences where I had been put in a hospital, in mental wards and whatnot, because I had been shown to be a threat to my own safety. And there have been times where I was a threat to other people's safety as well. So, you know, I definitely had been put away, you know, in other places other than just in jail. So I did my stints in jails and institutions. And I had the last time that I recall being in that, being in an institution, I had been hospitalized, and my husband, they said, had strangled me, but my blood alcohol level was a 4.2, and I went into an alcoholic coma. I think that lasted for 2 weeks. I'm not really sure. But I know that it's only by God's grace that I'm standing here today and I'm not a wet brain. Because that could have easily been what happened to me. So I ended up coming out of there and going back, you know, to live with this man in this shack in Kent County that it was all that we had. And there's that half gallon of vodka. I mean, you know, Bowman's in the plastic half gallon jar, and it's just sitting there on the table, just waiting for me. Get out of the hospital, get out of the alcoholic coma, just, you know, so I can start all over again. And I did. I started drinking again. And the day came not long after that, where I'm not even sure what was going on, but for whatever reason, I had become just as violent and crazy as that man that I was married to. You know, it was not a one-way street at this point. Yeah, a lot of it was self-protection, but, you know, maybe some of it wasn't. I really don't know. But he had, I had gotten drunk, and he was on one of his stretches where he wasn't drinking. And while he was asleep, evidently, I'd gotten on top of him with a knife and put an X-Acto knife to his throat. And he came too, you know, and here I am over top of him with a knife at his throat. And he looks at me and he says, "I wish you would." Because you see, he was living in the same alcoholic, torturous hell that I lived in every single day. And then I couldn't do it. You know, that man had hurt me over and over and over again. I mean, I was black and blue all over, and I couldn't, you know, I could not do it. Because I realized that he was going through the same thing I was going through. But right after that, it may have been a few days or a few weeks, but he wasn't drinking, but he ended up having a seizure from not drinking. He had a grandma seizure from not drinking. And I was watching him in the floor, and I really thought he was going to die. And I thought to myself, that's me. That's what's going to happen to me. This is, you know, I'm either going to drink myself to the point where I go into this coma again and I don't come out, or I'm going to be like him and I'm going to die in this shack on that floor from a seizure. And he didn't die. I did call 911. You know, he didn't die. That did something, you know, something that clicked something in my brain to really see it, you know, having come out of the hospital and then that happening right in front of me. I really realized that I was doomed to an alcoholic death, drinking or not drinking. It didn't matter. And that I had no hope. And that became my point of desperation. It was not long after that, I really cried out to God to help me. Now, I had sought some type of higher power throughout my drinking. I had gone to different churches. I tried different spiritual practices. I'd read all the books. You know, I was trying to find a way to solve my own problem. And so I had basically kind of sworn off God because none of those worked. And so I decided, you know, it was just a big hoax and, you know, there was no point in doing any of that because I'd tried it all and it didn't work. But when I became desperate enough, I was able to ask God to help me. And I said, please, God, get me sober or just let me die. You know, because I just can't live like this anymore. I can't do it. I'm so tired. And when I came to, I don't know when that was, but I came to, and the first time in a long time, I did not crave a drink. And there was no reason why I shouldn't have been. And I got what little bit of stuff I had together in my black trash bag, green, black, I don't know. It was gray or black. And I made my way back to Richmond. And I broke into my parents' house because they weren't there. And I started calling people that I knew, and I found them, and they came home, and they knew I was sick, and they knew I needed to get to a doctor, and thank God they did get me to a doctor. The other thing that they did for me was they took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and dropped me off. Now, I've been sentenced to AA plenty of times. But up to that point, there was not an AA meeting that I'd ever been to sober. Everyone I'd ever been to, I had been drinking. And, you know, when I cried out for help that night, I think I became open-minded to anything. And I didn't really believe you people, but you were the only hope I had left. So when you're hopeless and God has just dumped you, you know, in this situation, and you find yourself in an AA meeting, and you don't have any other, all the other doors closed, you know, this was the last stop on the block for me. It was a lady who was going to become my sponsor. I walked through the door of that meeting, and it was a ladies' meeting, and it was in the afternoon, so I think it might have been a weekend. And this woman walked up to me and put her arm around my shoulder and led me in the back room. And of course, I didn't know any better or any different at the time. She said, "Just sit right here. I'm going to go get you a cup of coffee." And she did. And she came back and she showed me this book. And she said, "This is the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has the directions on how we stay sober in it. And I'm going to be your sponsor. And we are going to go through this book together. And I'm going to show you how I stay sober and how other people in AA stay sober." And I mean, she was talking Greek to me, and I couldn't even hold my cup of coffee because I was still shaking so much. I got detoxed for 6 weeks outpatient by Dr. Peter Coleman. I don't think he practices anymore, but he has a practice still in Richmond. And God bless that man. He ended up, my parents didn't want me to stay there. You know, I just broke into the house. There was a lot, you know, tension with us. They put up with me about all they were going to put up with me. But my sister, she was a real enabler for me. And she took me in. The hell I put her through so many times. And I can't believe she did, but she took me in. She and her son had a little condo out in the West End, and she let me stay there on one condition, that I take Antabuse, which was kind of comical to me, but I didn't tell her that. And so I told Dr. Coleman, I said, I've got to have Antabuse. He said, "I don't think you need it." He said, I don't think you need Antabuse. I said, "No, but my sister does. She needs me to take it." He said, "I understand." And she did. She handed me that pill. She had to give it to me, and she had to watch me take it. And it brought her great comfort, you know, in doing that. And I was happy to do it, because by this time I truly had surrendered, and I was willing to do whatever you people told me to do. And I'm really grateful that that woman told me to do things. She, you know, maybe there were suggestions, but I didn't take them as suggestions because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anything. I had been not doing any kind of living, normal kind of living, for a very long time. And so she had to give me simple instructions, even just about life. You know, get up, brush your teeth, take a shower, brush your hair. I mean, because I'm like, I don't know what to do. You know, what do I do? I was terrified. And I mean, that is probably one of the greatest gifts and promises of the Big Book, that I don't spend my life terrified anymore, because I really was. I was just, not that I don't get scared still, because I do. I mean, you know, it's scary just to come up here and share my story with you guys, to be vulnerable like that. And I mean, I've been sharing my story for quite a number of years now, and it still is. But I was terrified of everything and everyone when I got here, and I didn't know anything about living a sober life. And I started doing exactly what that woman told me to do. And we met, and we did read the Big Book, and we did work these steps together. She made my home group her home group. We were greeters together. You know, she really practiced this, and by her actions, I was able to see what she was doing to stay sober every day. Now, she had another mental illness other than alcoholism. She was schizophrenic, And she ended up going back out when I was very new. But I have been blessed with being able to have God lead me to that same type of sponsor throughout my sobriety. Because that's what I learned. That's what I came in here with was, you know, we're going to read the book, we're going to work the steps. And so when those two paragraphs talk about having, you know, that spiritual journey and how I got there, well, I wouldn't have ever been able to get there if I hadn't have been a low bottom drunk. I wouldn't have been able to have the willingness that was necessary for me to have the experiences with God and you people that I'm able to have today. And I really believe that it took everything that it took in order for me to get to where I am now. And it took a lot of work. You know, I had to learn a new way of life, and it was not comfortable for a long time. But you know, this program has been magical in my life when I apply it. You know, that's the trick. You know, if I give lip service to it, it doesn't really give me anything back. But I will say, you know, sobriety has been a journey, and there have definitely been times when I have, you know, been more resting on my laurels. And I think COVID gave me that opportunity as well, you know, where that's what it felt like anyway. It felt like resting on my laurels because I wasn't active doing and going like I had been. So, and during those times, I know God was carrying me, you know, and I know this program was carrying me, you know, and not that I would ever want to rest on that for very long, because I today have a healthy fear of what life would be like if I didn't have that power greater than myself standing in between me and the next drink. Because without that, I have nothing. If I don't have that power to solve that problem for me, then I'm going to be drunk. 100%. Sure, I will be drunk. And so, you know, the program at Alcoholics Anonymous is the principles laid out in this book have become a way of life for me. And I don't practice those principles perfectly on any day of the week, but I try to keep it simple, and I try to stick to the basics that I've been taught here. Don't drink, go to meetings, read the literature, pray as often as possible, and talk with another alcoholic. And those five things, coupled with the steps and this book, have given me an incredible life. And yeah, I have the house. I don't have a picket fence, but I don't need one. And I have a wonderful relationship with my family. They're a big part of my life now. My children, I got custody of my son back. When I was 2.5 years sober, I did not get custody of my daughter back until I was almost 10 years sober. So she was much older by the time that I got any kind of custody back of her. I just had visitation with her for a long time. So those relationships have been repaired. I have a good job. You know, I'm a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least I hope to be on a daily basis. And those are all of the things in my life that have become the important things, you know, and I came in here not thinking any of that was possible. And, you know, I have been shown a life that was greater than I could have imagined for myself. My relationship and my spiritual journey, my relationship with God, my spiritual journey has looked differently throughout the last 26 years. You know, it's never been non-existent, thank goodness, but it has looked different. You know, I've tried going back to church. You know, I've tried other spiritual practices, and I have just tried Alcoholics Anonymous, and that works really good for me. And talking with other alcoholics. I come to in the morning, and the first thing that I do is pray. I have learned disciplines in this program, that routines and disciplines that I live by now, that I look forward to. I look forward to quiet time. I'm still a little ADHD, so I might not do it for very long. You know, it might only be 10, 15 minutes. Other days, it might be 30, you know, just depends. But it is an integral part of my day. And if I don't get to do it for whatever reason, for as long as I'd like to, I can get a little irritated. I just came off of spring break with my sister and her family, her husband and her kids, teenagers, all teenagers. Oh, what a joy. They are, though. I love them all very much. But, you know, teenagers can be a little challenging. My sister loves her one-on-one time with me in the mornings. And so here I'm trying to, you know, get my coffee and go sneak off by myself. Well, let me go, you know, hide out here. And sure enough, she'll stop working on the computer or doing whatever she's doing on her phone or the computer. The next thing I know, here she comes, you know, and I'm only 5 minutes in, and I'm like, you know, and I'm like, I have to remember that, you know, it's my willingness and the practice of it. I mean, God is with me all the time. You know, even if I don't get 10 minutes or however long, you know, to sit quietly, I can take a moment. And I've learned a lot about living in the moment, in the present moment. And that has helped me a great deal in sobriety, because that's where I am able to really be with God, in the present moment, because God's, you know, I can't find him in the past, and the future's not here yet, so he's not there, he, she, and whatever your version of whatever you call your God. It's right here in this moment, and so I try to hang on to those moments in the day that I have, you know, and I'm not always successful at it, but when I can remember that it's about right here and right now, and everything right here and right now is good, and God is with me, then I'm okay. You know, most of the time I'm better than okay. So it's been great to be with you guys tonight. I thank you for having me. I've spoken out here, I think, once or twice before. Once that I recall, and it's always a joy to come out and see you all and share with you, and keep coming back.